I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. By the late 19th century, Wilmington, North Carolina was a thriving majority black city. It had a sizable black middle class of professionals and merchants. There were black magistrates and police officers. There was a popular and influential black-owned newspaper, the Daily Record, and the city's local government was multiracial. This angered white supremacists, bitter over losing the Civil War and intent on ending black advancement, quote, by the ballot or the bullet or both. Our guest David Zucchino writes in his new book, Wilmington's Lie, about how these self-described white supremacists organized a campaign of terrorism, murder, and disenfranchisement that killed dozens of black residents, drove African Americans from the city, overthrew the elected government, and passed Jim Crow laws to subjugate the remaining black population. Zucchino has covered coups and civil wars in other countries. In fact, he got a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of apartheid in South Africa. He was a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's now a contributing writer to the New York Times, reporting from time to time from Afghanistan. David Zucchino, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us.
Great to
on
be
Radio
with you,
Times. Why don't we know this story?
Because it was covered up for many, many years, for more than a century. It was basically a white myth, and the people who perpetrated it perpetuated the myth. And the myth was that blacks were inferior, incapable of voting. They weren't intelligent enough to vote, and certainly they weren't intelligent enough to serve in public office. And at the same time, they spread rumors that there was going to be a black riot, that blacks were going to rise up. And this was the story that was told, that this was so sort of a, quote, good government initiative by honest white men to rid Wilmington of what they called, quote, Negro rule and Negro domination and a corrupt government. And unfortunately, they had to kill a few people.
Well, it was actually the opposite. It was a white race riot.
Yes, it was a racial coup. Really, it was a racial revolution, and they reinstored white supremacy as official policy, not only in Wilmington, but across North Carolina. Before, 2 days before the coup, there was a midterm election, which they stole by stuffing ballot boxes. But more importantly, they intimidated and terrorized black citizens into not voting. They had a group of vigilantes that were known as red shirts, and they were basically an outgrowth of the Klan. And their job during the spring, summer, and fall of 1898, leading up to the election, was to ride out into the Cape Fear countryside and burst into black homes at night and yank black men out and beat them and whip them and say, if you dare register to vote, we'll come back and kill you. So they were able, through intimidation and terror, to basically shut down the black vote.
Well, let's roll back the clock a little bit before 1898, and Wilmington, North Carolina, it's a port city, but it did become a kind of, I won't say haven exactly, but it was a place where there was a majority black population, and there was this middle class, this professional class in this city.
Yes, it was 56% black, which was very unusual for a southern city at that time. New Orleans at that time was 27% black, and Louisville was 17%. So this was unusual. What was more unusual is that it had a multiracial government, and it had black men in positions of power. There was a Baptist publication that came out in 1898, called Wilmington, quote, the freest town for a Negro in the country. I mean, it was a black mecca. There were jobs at the port and in the naval stores industry. There was a strong black middle class, as you said. There was a professional class. There were 65 professionals in Wilmington, doctors, lawyers, funeral directors, ministers, all educated at black universities. Blacks sold goods from the white city market, which was highly unusual at that time in the South. And they had combined with white Republicans, and they had the black voting power to help put Republicans in office statewide and in Wilmington. And as rewards, they were given jobs as magistrates. 10 of the 26 police officers were black. 3 of the 10 city aldermen were black. The superintendent of streets was black, the city coroner, and so on. So it was a real black mecca.
Well, and this was the fusionists, right? The Republican Party coalescing or hooking up with the populace, and these group called the Fusionists.
Right. The populist party was made up mostly of poor white farmers, and in the early 1890s, there was a terrible recession and crop prices plummeted, and the white farmers were disillusioned. They had been aligned with the Democratic Party, which was the party of white supremacy, but they felt that they had aligned themselves with moneyed interests like the banks and the railroads, and they weren't paying attention to bread and butter issues like education for their kids and jobs. And they made the decision, which was a bold decision, to move over to the Republican Party, which meant that they aligned themselves with black voters. And this was called fusion, the melding of the populace with the Republicans, both black and white. And they took over the state legislature in 1994. And then the next year, they took over Wilmington city government.
And the Democrats are really the party of white supremacy.
Correct. And whether it's the opposite of what they are today, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln and the party of black suffrage. And almost all African-Americans voted Republican at that time.
There's so many people in this book I want to talk about. We won't get to all of them. But one person I think we should know was a man named Abraham Galloway. I would say a fearless man. He became a state senator, and he really took on white supremacy.
He was an incredible figure. He was a slave. He escaped from Wilmington on a ship bound for Philadelphia. And he ended up in Philadelphia and was taken in by the Vigilance Committee, and this was a stop on the Underground Railroad. And he went on to become a spy for the Union Army. He just had an incredible life story, and they sent him back down through the South to report through the Confederate States on what was happening. He reported back to the Union Army. In 1868, he became the first black man to run for office in North Carolina and was elected as a state senator. And he led throughout, and he was from Wilmington, he led resistance to white supremacy at that time. There's an amazing chapter in the book where he, in 1868, where North Carolina, along with other states, was required to pass a new constitution after the war. And there was a referendum coming up, and the white supremacists were trying to suppress the black votes. This is the first time blacks had been able to vote. So the Ku Klux Klan was organized in Wilmington, which was the biggest city in North Carolina, the most important city, and they had a campaign to terrorize and intimidate blacks. Well, Galloway was there, and he raised an informal black militia. They carried clubs and fence posts, and they met the two nights before the election. They clashed with the Klan in Wilmington, drove the Klan out of Wilmington, and then the Klan did not appear on the streets of Wilmington again until the 1920s. So he was an amazing figure.
You also quote him as saying, and this is, I think, at giving a speech, the white man says he don't want to be placed on equality with the Negro. Well, sir, if you could only get him, if you could only see him slipping around at night trying to get into Negro women's houses, you would be astonished. You know, I have to say, and we'll get to some of this a little bit later in the hour, so much of the vitriol, the anger, the violence, the murder has to do with manhood and women's virtue and trying to, from the white supremacist point of view, trying to address what they see as just this sort of shocking demand for equality coming from African Americans.
Oh, exactly. The white supremacists were threatened on two fronts. One was the black majority vote. That was terrifying. But more importantly was the threat, the sexual threat to their manhood by black men who they thought were attacking the virtue of white women. And they had a propaganda campaign during the summer of 1898 led by the newspapers, and they reported falsely that blacks were rampaging through the countryside, raping white women. There was no rape epidemic, but they came up with the term black beast rapist, and they portrayed blacks as a threat to white womanhood, and that's why they had to be suppressed and defeated.
In fact, you describe, I guess, what really, there were several sparks to what happened in Wilmington, North Carolina, but one was a letter to an editor that a woman wrote in Georgia, of all places.
It was a speech, yes, in Georgia.
And a speech in Georgia having to do with essentially what you just said. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, her name was Felton. Rebecca Felton. She was a well-known speaker. She was the wife of a congressman, and she gave a speech down in Georgia about the supposed rape epidemic, and she said the only solution was the lynch rope. And part of her speech was a phrase where she says, "I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary." So naturally, this speech was reprinted immediately in the white papers in Wilmington, and Alex Manley saw it, the editor of the black paper there, and he immediately sat down and wrote an editorial in response, which shocked not only Wilmington, but whites across the South. He said that many black men who were accused of rape were in fact consensual lovers of white women, and more importantly, as Galloway had said, that white men raped black women with impunity. It happened all the time. And he pointed that out. And if you'd like, I can read a couple of lines from that editorial. And this was in August of 1868.
Please do.
Quote, "Every Negro lynched is called a, quote, big, burly, black brute, when in fact many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers and were not only black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them, as is very well known to all. Let virtue be something more than an excuse for them to intimidate and torture a helpless people. Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman. You set yourselves down as a lot of carping hypocrites in that you cry aloud for the virtue of your women while you seek to destroy the morality of ours." And as you can imagine, this did not go over well with the white supremacists. And in fact, this editorial was reprinted across the South. And immediately, the red shirts, which was the militia of the white supremacists, they were vigilantes, they mounted up and wanted to lynch Manley. And to show you how calculated and premeditated this whole coup was, this was in August. They said, "No, not now. We'll have a greater political impact if we wait till November for the elections. We can use this. This will be a great tool for us." And they said, "We promise you, you can lynch Manley in November and you can burn his newspaper."
Well, they did burn his newspaper, the building down. We're almost up in a break here, but it should be said that Manley's great-grandfather was the white governor of North Carolina.
Correct. His grandfather.
His grandfather.
Was the white governor of North Carolina, Charles Manley. And in fact, he quote, looked white and could have passed as white, which a lot of mixed race people did then. And he adamantly refused to do so. He lived his life as a black man.
And this was a very influential newspaper. As you said, even whites put ads in his newspaper, the Daily Record.
Yes, it was a very influential paper. Its banner said it claimed to be the only Negro daily in the world. Well, it wasn't, but it was one of few. It was a daily newspaper, and it had a lot of influence across North Carolina and into South Carolina in the black community. And as you say, whites advertised in it. One white reporter called it, quote, a very credible colored paper. This was before the coup, of course.
That is David Zucchino, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. It's about Wilmington, North Carolina, that was for a time after the Civil War, a thriving majority black city. The coup was engineered in many ways by local white supremacists. We're going to talk more about them after this very short break. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with David Zucchino about his new book. It's called Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. We were talking about some of the black activists, I would say, in Wilmington, North Carolina. Let's talk about some of the white supremacists, including the one that owned, I guess, the counter paper to the Daily Record.
Yes. His name was Josephus Daniels, and he was the publisher of the News and Observer in Raleigh, the state capital, and it was king of media of the day. Of course, there was no internet, no radio and TV, and newspapers were king, and his newspaper was the most powerful voice in North Carolina. And I worked My first job out of school was at the News and Observer in Raleigh, and Josephus Daniels was this revered figure in the newsroom. There were all these tributes to him. He went on to become Secretary of the Navy and Ambassador to Mexico, and they characterized him as this wonderful man. I worked there 5 years, never knew that he was the leader of the white supremacy campaign in North Carolina. In fact, I went to high school and college in North Carolina and never heard of this event. It wasn't taught at all in the history books. It wasn't mentioned by professors, and I only heard about it 20 years ago. But Josephus Daniels started, and they called it, by the way, the White Supremacy Campaign in caps. That was the name that they gave to their movement, so they were very open about what they were trying to do. But his newspaper, the News and Observer, led a propaganda campaign by planting these false stories about alleged attacks on white women by blacks, about how incompetent black rule was, and they called it Negro domination and Negro rule, and said that, as you said earlier, we will end it by the ballot or the bullet or both. They made it clear.
And it was both.
And it was both. And in his editorials and in his story, he said, if violence is necessary, that's what we're going to do. So they announced this well ahead of time. And this was picked up by other white newspapers in the state. And what's very interesting is because they announced ahead of time what they were going to do, during the summer and the fall of 1898, all the major newspapers in the country, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, papers all across the Eastern Seaboard and in the South, sent their white reporters down to cover what they called the race war in North Carolina. And when they were met at the train station, the white supremacists would meet them there and give them cigars and whiskey and arrange their lodging, and they would, quote, embed the reporters with them. They would take reporters around with the white gunmen who had set up military zones around the city in preparation for the coup and fill them with the white narrative. And unfortunately, many of the papers reported this, and this was the picture people had of Wilmington before. It was the white narrative before the coup, and then after the night where the white narrative really took hold. And Josephus Daniels was really the leader of this whole campaign, the propaganda part of it.
Here's some of the lyrics to the white supremacy campaign, again in caps. Proud Caucasians, one and all, hear your wives and daughters call. Rise, defend their spotless virtue with your strong and manly arms. Rise and drive this black despoiler from your state.
Yes, that's what they used to sing at these so-called red shirt rallies. And what's interesting, this was a propaganda campaign, but it was also a military campaign. As I said, they had the red shirts, who were the vigilantes, but they also had two state militias in Wilmington. One was called the Wilmington Light Infantry, and the other one was called the Naval Reserves. And these were state militias, like the National Guard. But they were commanded by white supremacists, made up of white supremacists, and answered to the white supremacist leaders. And during the summer, the merchants, the white merchants in Wilmington, raised $10,000 to buy one of the most lethal guns available. It was one of the first machine guns. It was a Colt rapid-fire gun that could fire 420 rounds a minute.
Wow.
And they supplied that to the Wilmington Light Infantry for use against blacks on the day of the coup. And this was the summer of the Spanish-American War, and the white units were called up for federal service. But the white leaders made sure that they were back in Wilmington on the day of the coup, November 10th, 1898, so they could be used against the black population. And they were still in federal service. They were federal soldiers, which meant that federal soldiers murdered American citizens with impunity. And at the same time, there were black units, and they were called up. The segregated units, they were called up, but the white leaders made sure they were stuck on a training base in Georgia, hundreds of miles away, on the day of the coup, so the black community was completely defenseless.
One little thing I just wanted to pick up, having to do with all these reporters coming to Wilmington, North Carolina, to cover this story. You also write that many reporters from the North looked down on both the white Southerners, thinking they were, I don't know, crackers or, you know, some kind of disparaging thing, but also on the freed African-Americans, thinking they were incapable of governing.
Exactly. I think they truly believed. I mean, there was plenty of racism in the North. But as you say, many of them did look down on the whites as, you know, hicks and country folks. But at the same time, they didn't even have to buy the white narrative because they believed that blacks were inferior. And there were several comments in northern newspapers that, well, the whole problem was giving blacks the right to vote. We wouldn't have this problem if they didn't vote. And these were northern newspapers. Right. So they definitely picked up that narrative and kept it alive after the coup.
You have some testimony from a Reverend J. Allen Kirk. He was there and he witnessed really what happened to I think you said something like 60 African-American men were killed. At least 60 were killed. Many people fled into the swamps for fear of their lives. And you describe or you include some of his descriptions of what went on. And it is a terror campaign. I think we can't back away from that.
If you can imagine, here are these white gunmen, and some of them are actually federal soldiers, running through the streets, murdering black men, as you say, at least 60, and many, many more were wounded. You can imagine the effect this must have had on black families. They were just terrorized, so hundreds of them just picked up, and this was in November, and it's cold and wet, and fled to the swamps and to the cemeteries, and particularly a black cemetery where they thought the white gunmen wouldn't go, and they spent 2 nights and 3 days just terrified in this bitter cold and rain. There were reports from Reverend Kirk that at least one baby died of exposure. And then by the time they felt it was safe enough to come back, they just came back just long enough to gather their possessions and flee the city. And then in the days and weeks after the riot, 2,100 black people left Wilmington, and it was never again a black majority city. Today it's 18%. Back then it was 56% black.
Wow. He also says the mob took the leading colored ministers and compelled them to go around the city with them and ask the colored people to be obedient to the white people and go in their homes and keep quiet. This was a great humiliation for us and a shame upon our denominations, talking about other fellow preachers.
Exactly. And in fact, white ministers were active. They were out in the streets with Winchesters taking part. I don't know that they ever shot anyone, but they were out there in support of the mobs. And the coup was on a Thursday. And on the Sunday after the coup, there were these great celebrations in the white churches. And the ministers gave these thumping sermons where they said, we've finally gotten rid of Negro domination. We'll never be ruled by Negroes again. This was a great victory. They compared it to taking Jerusalem. And one of them said, we have taken a city. Mm-hmm. So there was jubilation and celebrations. And the ministers were a very big part of that.
And that is David Zucchino, again, our guest on Radio Times. Today we're talking about his brand new book. It's called Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Again, about a coup. I don't think you can back away from that word. In Wilmington, North Carolina, it was a large city, a thriving black middle class city. It was a campaign of violence and terrorism, murder, disenfranchisement, led to the overthrow of the city's elected government. And as we've been saying, the death of some 60 African-American men, the destruction of a way of life. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I will admit, this is a piece of history I did not know about until I read this book. We talked about some of the other white supremacists. Let's talk about Alfred Moore Waddell. He was one of the leaders of the white resistance.
Yes, Alfred Moore Waddell was a former colonel in the Confederacy. He was a former United States congressman. He was a newspaper man, and he was the leading white supremacist of the city, and he was an incredible orator, and he gave these terrorizing speeches across the southeastern North Carolina, particularly in Wilmington, inciting whites to attack blacks. And in fact, the night before the election, he gave a very chilling speech, and he told the red shirts and other whites, 1,000 men gathered at City Hall the night before, and told them, excuse me, if you see the Negro out voting, stop him in his tracks. If he continues, shoot him, kill him dead. He actually ordered them to shoot black people, and of course they did the next day.
There was essentially an attack on the elected government at the time. Were members of that government, were they killed? Were they kind of frog marched out of the city hall? What was their fate?
Yeah, Colonel Waddell led the march. First of all, he led the march to the black newspaper, and they were given permission then by the leaders to burn. They burned down the newspaper. Alex Madley had fled to Philadelphia, as a matter of fact, yeah. 2 nights before he escaped the lynch mob. And then Waddell led the mob to City Hall. They told the there at that time they had gone from 10 to 8 city aldermen. Three of them were black, and they said at gunpoint they removed them, and they, quote, elected themselves to replace them as aldermen, mayor, and police chief and other positions. Waddell appointed himself as mayor, so you had the leader of the mob appointing himself as the new mayor, and he served two terms after that. They came up with a banishment list of 50 blacks and whites. So the blacks they didn't kill, and these were members of city government, and lawyers, doctors, the entire black professional class, along with white traitors, race traitors, as they called the white leaders, marched them at gunpoint to the train station, put them on the train, and said, if you ever come to Wilmington again, we will shoot you on sight. Not one of those men ever came back, not one of them.
Well, but there were African-Americans who remained in Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm trying to imagine what they must have been poor.
Yes,
or had no place to go.
They couldn't afford to leave, basically.
Yeah. I mean, what was life for them after this coup?
It was terrorizing, and the best they could do was go along with white rule. And there were all these editorials in the white newspapers saying, we are not your enemy. You just have to know your place. And they used that term. They said, as long as Negroes know their place, you won't have any problems with us. So there was no more resistance to white rule after that. I mean, obviously, people were terrified and intimidated. And gradually, over the years, more and more blacks just fled the city. And it was hollowed out, and it became a white supremacist stronghold. And in fact, they set white supremacy as state policy and Jim Crow as state policy for more than 50 years. There was in 1898, there was one black congressman in the entire country. He was George Henry White. He was from North Carolina, and he represented a district that abutted Wilmington, and he spent a lot of time in Wilmington, and he was hounded out because he was black and because he was a congressman. He was hounded out of the city and the state by Josephus Daniels at the News Observer, who actually used the N-word in an editorial to describe him. And after he fled North Carolina in 1900, no black citizen represented North Carolina in Congress until 1992, nearly a century later. And after those three black aldermen were driven out of town at gunpoint, no black served on the city council until 1972. So you can see how effective this was. And in fact, blacks did not vote in any appreciable numbers from 1898 until the passage of the
1898.
Sorry, until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. In 1896, there were 126,000 black men registered to vote. By 1902, just 6 years later, there were 6,000. It shows you how effective this was in suppressing the black vote.
But you also say this happened in other cities. Perhaps other cities looked at Wilmington, North Carolina, the white supremacists, thinking, well, we can do to our city what the white supremacists did to North Carolina.
It inspired Wilmington. White supremacists across the South. I'll give you just one example. In 1906, there was a statewide race in Georgia. And the white supremacists there were trying to figure out a way to suppress and intimidate the blacks to suppress the vote. The first thing they did was consult the leaders of the white supremacy movement in Wilmington to show how to do it. And they did the same thing. They terrorized blacks. They stuffed ballot boxes, and they won the election. And there was a man named Hoke Smith, who was a white supremacist, who was elected governor. And he said, after he consulted with the whites in Wilmington, saying, we can handle our blacks the way they did in Wilmington, where the woods were black with their hanging carcasses. That was his direct quote.
Wow. A number of black leaders appealed to then-President McKinley, basically asking him to come help protect them or save them. As you write, McKinley did not respond.
He did not. Even before and after the coup, George Henry White, the congressman, met in the White House with McKinley, told him what was going to happen. He said, they are going to kill us. They're going to take over the city. There's going to be a coup. Black ministers, a delegation of black ministers, met with McKinley. And the same thing happened after the coup. George Henry White and the ministers met with McKinley, and I could find no record that he uttered one word in public about the coup, and no one was ever punished. No one was indicted or arrested, much less served time. They completely got away with it.
And yet my understanding for McKinley was he wasn't an overt racist, if I can put it that way. In fact, I think he tried to make his cabinet more diverse than other cabinets. So it's such a curious thing to think
that
he would stand on the sidelines knowing that another part of him was doing something to help the advancement of African Americans.
McKinley was an abolitionist. He had served in the Union Army. He gave a speech at the Republican Convention in 1888, warning that whites across the South were suppressing the black vote. But he was under a lot of political pressure then. The negotiations with Spain after the Spanish-American War were going badly. He was getting criticism for that. U.S. soldiers were dying of yellow fever in Cuba and Puerto Rico. He was under intense criticism from Congress for not supporting the troops. At the same time, he needed white votes, not just in North Carolina, but throughout the South, and I think he did not want to antagonize them. And excuse me, also he was very aware that since he was elected 2 years earlier, the black vote had been completely suppressed in North Carolina and elsewhere in the South. Blacks had helped put him in office, but he realized that they weren't going to be voting when he ran for re-election. So I think he made a very cynical and calculated decision that just keep quiet, don't antagonize the whites.
Here's an email from Sue. Why is this not taught in every school? I'm a history buff. I'm 80 years old, and I've never heard about the Wilmington coup. I'm sure this is a question you get asked a lot, David Zucchino.
This was very deliberate. As you know, Victor's right history and the white supremacists controlled the narrative of this for more than a century. The school textbooks in North Carolina barely mentioned it, but when they did, it was mentioned as a good government initiative, and unfortunately the good people of the South, the whites, had to rise up and get rid of a corrupt Negro rule. And if you'd like, I can read you a quote from one of the textbooks.
Well, you know, I'd love to have you do that. I'm just looking at the clock here. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We'll have you read from a 1940 textbook from the South, having to do with the KKK. Again, David Zucchino is our guest. He won a Pulitzer Prize a number of years ago for his coverage of apartheid in South Africa. He reports from time to time for the New York Times from Afghanistan, and he's written a new book we've been talking about. It's called Wilmington's Lie, not Wilmington, Delaware, but Wilmington, North Carolina, subtitled The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And we want to hear from you as well. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining our conversation, our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Zucchino. His new book sheds light on a little-known incident, a 19th-century white supremacist riot in Wilmington, North Carolina, terrorized the black residents of the city, overthrew the government there. The book is titled Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Well, let's talk. We're jumping forward here, and this is a textbook that was used in the 1940s. Public school textbook. As you write, a 1940 public school textbook blamed black citizens for the misfortunes that befell them. If you could read from this textbook, that would be
right. This is
excellent.
A public school textbook that was taught to school children in 1940. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, there are people alive today who were taught this as children. And this is talking about the need for the Klan and the red shirts. Quote, "To put an end to this terrible condition, white people joined together in a sort of club, in which they named the Ku Klux Klan. Members dressed as ghosts and scared lawless men into acting decently. On moonlit nights, these men could be seen on horseback, riding to bring order back into the lives of their people. Such sights frightened Negroes into living better lives. The names of these men, Negro or white, who had done wrong were listed. The next moonlit night, the Klan would visit these men and punish them according to the wrongs they had done. After this, lawless men were not so bold, and crime became less and less."
I don't even know where to begin. A sort of a club called the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, this was a terrorist organization, still is in many ways today.
Oh, absolutely. They were vigilantes and terrorists. And as I was writing this book, the new movement of today, the white nationalist movement, was coming up. And as I was writing this book, Charlottesville happened. There are so many things today, the incitement, the scapegoating of people on social media by politicians. I can give you one example. In 1898, Alex Manley, the black editor, in addition to receiving many, many death threats, was constantly told to go back to Africa. And just this summer, we had three American congresswomen of color told to go back to their home countries. Another example is, as I mentioned, white voters in 1898 were told that blacks were coming to rape their women and steal their jobs. A presidential candidate in 2015 came down the escalator and said Mexican criminals and rapists, to use the term rapists, were coming across the border to steal American jobs. So you can hear the echoes of 1898 in today's political discourse in the demonizing and the singling out of people of color and certain ethnic groups for incitement.
Do you think, based on our history, that there's always this undercurrent of white supremacy? And, I mean, every now and then it sort of bubbles up either because it has been promoted or supported by people who have some kind of influence. That this is, in a sense, our legacy?
Yes, I think that's been there. It's been there for more than 100 years, well over 100 years. I think it's baked into some elements of the white population. And I think Donald Trump really ignited that. He spoke to these people. They felt this way. And now it's sort of permissible to come up and just let it out. And it's out there. And it's on the surface. On the surface, you see what happened in Charlottesville. Yeah. You see the incitement on social media. It's not gone by any means. It is still out there.
I was reading the KKK anthem, and it had a very familiar ring from what we heard in Charlottesville. I mean, a more modern version of that. But there it is.
Yeah, I was thinking when I was writing this book and I was reading about what happened in Charlottesville, and I was thinking those very fine people, as Trump called them, who were carrying torches and chanting "Jews will not replace us," they would have felt right at home in Wilmington in 1898.
Mm. How about Wilmington now? Well, Wilmington, North Carolina now.
Yes, as you can imagine, this story is very much alive down there. In 1998, the University of North Carolina at Wilmington held a centennial. And I really admire them. They worked very hard to try to bring blacks and whites together after 100 years. And they said, you know what? It's time to tell the real story of what happened. This white myth has got to end. And they got descendants from blacks and whites, brought them together. They had black and white choirs singing together in the same church where that minister said we had taken a city. They brought people together at Thalian Hall, which was where Colonel Waddell gave that speech telling white red shirts to kill blacks, and where the night before the coup, the whites had met and issued a declaration of white independence. And the organizers of this event 100 years later brought them together exactly 100 years later and had blacks and whites sign a declaration of black and white interdependence. So there was some reconciliation, but it is still there today, and there is these strong undercurrents on both sides. People still remember, and the pain is still there.
You talk about in 2006 there was a state commission report, so looking at what happened in Wilmington, North Carolina, where they talked about a documented conspiracy. So, I mean, it seems like there is at least some small progress on acknowledging this.
Yes,
this
there
true
is acknowledgement.
History.
And this commission, there was a law passed, and it was introduced by two black members of the state legislature from Wilmington. And this commission, made up of both blacks and whites, mostly historians and academics, spent 5 years digging into this. And as you say, they produced the true account of what it really was, which was a racial coup and a massacre. So I think that really helped bring up together some reconciliation in North Carolina by at least acknowledging it. And the News and Observer, which today is a mainstream Democratic liberal progressive newspaper on the editorial page, in 2006 did a 19-part series telling what really happened, and on the editorial page issued a long apology for the actions of Josephus Daniels.
Well, and as you say, for decades, there really was complete disenfranchisement in Wilmington, North Carolina, probably North Carolina and other states as well. But it did take the federal government, the civil rights, the voting rights, other acts of the federal government to at least begin to address the stain.
Right. I mean, the federal government stood aside back in 1898, but during the civil rights movement and under LBJ, Civil Rights Act was passed, the Voting Rights Act, a lot of other acts. And it wasn't until then that blacks, not only in North Carolina, but across the South, finally got the opportunity to vote in significant numbers. But even today, white conservatives in North Carolina have come up with a voter ID bill. That was specifically aimed at suppressing the African-American vote. The federal courts struck it down, saying race was the consideration, and one of the judges said that the law targeted African-Americans with almost surgical precision.
Wow.
So it has been struck down as a direct and blatant attempt to suppress the black vote. So here we are, still at it.
Well, we're still at it. For a while, there was the possibility of voter ID in Pennsylvania. That also was struck down. But you do see this in other jurisdictions and other states as well. Is this the kind of legacy of Jim Crow?
I think it is. It's sort of another poll tax and a literacy test, which is how the white supremacists used to keep blacks from voting. But I really think this is another attempt. And I am glad the federal government now is doing the right thing and interceding and striking down these laws. There's also gerrymandering. In 1898, there were two black wards in Wilmington, and the whites crammed the blacks into these two wards to dilute their voting power. And today, white conservatives in North Carolina have gerrymandered two congressional districts by packing blacks into these two long serpentine districts. Those districts were ruled to be racial gerrymanders in violation of the 14th Amendment by the federal courts, and the Supreme Court last year upheld it. And they threw out all those districts, and they have to rewrite them.
But nonetheless, the effort is still there.
The effort is there.
Dawn writes, is there any institution like a museum in Wilmington that presents this information in order for the public to learn more in Wilmington, North Carolina?
Yes, a good question. As a result of the efforts in 1998, they produced a memorial. So there is a memorial, a large memorial at the site of where the first shots were fired by the whites against the blacks. And there's a lot of historical information there that presents what really happened, and it corrects the historical record. And the state also put up a new state marker that describes what really happened. And interestingly enough, Alex Manley had a marker put up several years ago, and it still calls it a race riot. And that marker is still up today.
You call it a coup.
Yeah, it was a coup. And so does the new marker, and the new memorial calls it a coup. But this marker with Alex Manley. And Alex Manley, by the way, spent the last 40 years of his life in Philadelphia.
In fact, I wanted to follow up on that. What brought him here and what kept him here?
Yeah, as I say, he fled. He barely got out alive. He went first to Washington and tried to restart the Daily Record with his brother, and it didn't work. And so he came up to Philadelphia. He and his wife was named Carrie, who was actually an internationally known singer who had sung in London. They took an apartment at 11th and Walnut, and they lived in a rooftop apartment, and he got a job as the janitor. And he later found work as a painter, and he was hired, he realized, because he looked white. And finally, he admitted that he was black, and some of the people fired him. Some let him continue to work. They moved to an Irish neighborhood, and I'm not sure where it is. I wish I knew where it was. But everything was fine because Manley looked white. They thought his wife was his servant.
Oh,
and that
goodness.
Was fine. As soon as they found out that she was his wife, they put up a spiked fence in between their house and the rest of the neighborhood. And Manley became involved in something called the Armstrong Association, which was started by a Quaker. And he was one of the founders. And it was designed to teach industrial skills to young black men who, like him, had moved up from the South. And this became part of the National Urban League and the Urban League in Philadelphia. So he had quite an impact on events right here in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia.
And he's buried just outside the city, right?
Yeah, he's buried in Willow Grove. Yes.
In Willow Grove.
He died in 1944.
Wow, a long life.
Yeah, a long and very fruitful life after he left Wilmington. And by the way, he never went back.
Never went back.
It was too dangerous.
Did he have family back there?
Oh, yeah. He had some family. Most of his family left, but some of his descendants took part in these events in 1998.
Well, you're a newspaper person. Yourself, David Zucchino. And this book, in many ways, is about dueling newspapers and how local newspapers, whether they were black or they were white, covered this piece of history, or whether they were from the North or from the South. And, you know, here we are trying to struggle with newspapers and news and reports today. And I'm just curious about where you think we are today.
Well, I was really struck then by the use of so-called fake news, and it really was fake news with this white propaganda campaign. And at the same time, the Daily Record, the black newspaper, struggling as hard as it could to give the true story of what was happening in the South, and got, as a result, was burned down and all its archives were destroyed, yeah. Which was terrible for me in researching this book. And today, well, actually, you see the proliferation of, quote, fake news everywhere. I mean, not the fake news that Donald Trump talks about, but what just has taken over on social media, unsubstantiated claims that people believe. And now you have Russians interfering in the election in 2016 and going to do it again. And people believing what they see on social media, on the internet, because it reinforces their perceptions, both liberals and conservatives. And I find this very disturbing that people are in these camps and select their own, quote, news. And we have a president who disparages the establishment, the so-called responsible media, as enemies of the people, which really enrages me, turning the way the president turns people against the newspapers and media that try very hard to be factual and cite their sources, unlike what you find on social media.
But this story is also about how propaganda led to this murderous coup, as you said. I mean, there were other things obviously at play, but the fact that you could write stories that were untrue that just got the white population absolutely apoplectic.
It did. It incited them to violence, and that was the whole point. And it worked very well. And I'm concerned today. Now, the so-called white nationalists aren't as nakedly, overtly racist by any means as the white supremacists were back then. But I'll give you one example. Last summer, our president told the nation that there was a Hispanic invasion coming across the border. He repeated it again and again. Well, in August, as you remember, a white man in El Paso went to a Walmart, singled out Hispanics, shot 22 of them dead, and later told the police he did it because he was concerned about an Hispanic invasion. And I know you can't draw a straight line between incitement and violence, but I feel the same sort of racial hatred and racial resentments bubbling up the same way it did in 1898.
Because of times of change and insecurity and sort of worry about the future, I think. I mean, I think that sort of feeds people's prejudices.
And that's the way people were feeling. The whites were in 1819. A lot of this was economic because lower class, working class whites and blacks were competing for the same jobs. And in Wilmington, they hired the blacks, first of all, because they were better at their jobs. They worked harder and because they weren't likely to complain or demand higher wages or better conditions. And the whites were. And this was a real bone of contention. And it was one of the things driving the coup and taking over. And the first thing they did was fire every single black employee in the city, gave white people their jobs, also disbanded the two black fire companies, took all their equipment and gave it to whites. And the street sweepers used to be black, became white. And Waddell, Colonel Waddell, who became the mayor, wanted to cut the salary from 10 cents a day to 8, and they rose up and said, don't forget who put you in office. The whites did. And they forgot all about cutting the salary because they were white street sweepers now.
Well, David Zucchino, it's an incredible story. Thank you so much for writing the book and for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great being with you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Our guest, David Zucchino, is speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.